Hi, I'm Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. Today is Monday, December 9th, 2013, and this is the 12th episode of the show. You can find the show at theastrologypodcast.com, and you can also listen to us on iTunes. My guest today is world-renowned astrologer Robert Hand, who is known for books such as Planets in Transit, Planets in Composite, and Horoscope Symbols. He's getting ready to present a two-day online webinar on whole sign houses later this week on December 14th and 15th, and you can find out more information about it on his website at arhatmedia.com. Our topic today is rebuilding the links between modern and traditional astrology. So with that introduction out of the way, Rob, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to your webinar on whole sign houses, and that actually ties in very nicely with our topic today, because recently you've been writing some articles and some blog posts on Facebook about something that you've become very interested in, which is rebuilding the links between modern and traditional astrology. And I think it's interesting because I was talking with a friend recently, and we're talking about how, because everybody seems to know your name, and you're certainly one of the most famous astrologers in the world, certainly within the astrological community, if not the most famous astrologer. But it's interesting because we're talking about how that is or why everybody knows your name, and it seems to oftentimes go back to planets in transit, especially, and to a lesser extent, maybe planets in composite. Is that true, or do you say that that's how you got well-known?
That's part of it, and I've also been very active on the lecture circuit for most of this period. I'm a little less so now, and doing workshops and things of that sort. So, and I've been involved in astrological organizations, so there are a number of reasons, but planets in transit are certainly a major factor.
Sure. Yeah, and I know you've done a lot of work. You were president of the NCJR at one point, and you were involved in different translation projects, so you're obviously very well-known to professionals. But it's interesting because even people like myself who came into the astrological community relatively recently in the past decade or two know your name largely through planets and transits and some of those things. But that's interesting because you wrote some of those books quite a while ago now in the 70s and 80s, and your approach to astrology has changed somewhat since that time, or pretty significantly. But it seems like a lot of the people that may only know you from those books don't realize that. But it seems like that change started in the 90s when you got interested in traditional astrology.
Yeah, I always actually have been interested in traditional astrology, but the material wasn't available. Mm-hmm. Not even Lilly. that happened in the 80s. And Robert Zoller was my first real entree to it. He came and talked with a group of us at the early meetings of what became the New York chapter of NCGR. Actually, that was the first chapter of NCGR, and I was rather struck by the fact that he had actually learned Latin in order to read the stuff in the original. Mm. But I continued basically following I won't say I ever really did conventional modern astrology. I always did. I was more into cosmobiology, the Aberdeen school, because it had a certain kind of definiteness about it, which, interestingly enough, is rather like that of traditional astrology, although the technique's completely different. And it's sort of the funny thing is that you can divide my astrology career into two phases. The first phase was when I was doing workshops where I had to teach everybody to use the 90-degree dial to look at midpoints, and the second phase where I had to show everybody a table of essential dignity so they know how to use that.
Sure. And the dial phase, I mean, that comes through really clearly in horoscope symbols that was the direction you were headed in. And you even, I think you told me once that Eberton and some of the delineations in combination of stellar influences were part of the main influence on the delineations in planets in transit, right? Or some influence on the delineations?
Some influence, mainly the manner of approach. I mean, if you look at one of my delineations and one of his combinations, you will see that I obviously fleshed it out a lot from somewhere. And basically, I did, in fact, look at other people who've written on transits, mostly as a negative reference point. His little booklet on transits was very terse but quite usable because, again, it was clear. Mm-hmm. And then I fleshed it out based on my own understandings.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a big difference between the one brief sentence that Eberton would give for whatever planetary combination and the page-long delineation for the transits that you ended up producing.
Right.
So
well, that had to be because that was written as a text for a computer program, which is in somewhat modified form is now available from Astrodienst or Astro.com, which is another reason why I'm known outside of the professional circles.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that it was originally written for a computer program in the 70s. And then, Astro.com is certainly – that's how I originally became familiar with your work through those delineations. And I think a lot of people now – it's sort of introduced your work to a whole new generation of astrologers in the past decade because everybody uses Astro.com and everyone therefore reads your delineations on a pretty much daily basis.
Yeah, I have to say that some of the delineations have been modified beyond recognition, but it is basically my work, yes.
Oh, yeah. I was doing one recently because I was going to quote you for delineation of Saturn going through the 10th house when I was writing an article last year before the presidential election about Obama because he had Saturn ingressing into Scorpio, which is his 10th whole sign house. And in the Astro.com delineation, in your original delineation, you pointed out that Nixon had a Saturn going through his 10th house, I think, in quadrant houses when he had his downfall. And that portion of it was removed from the Astro.com delineation, interestingly.
Oh, because it's not relevant to modern people.
Right. Well, yeah, it's a very concrete sort of statement about something that might happen literally that's not necessarily a psychological thing.
Right.
Okay. So anyway, so and those delineations are very much motivated by psychological astrology and maybe some, I want to say some Jungianism, at least in terms of how you tell people or advise them to deal with transits in sometimes internalizing them so that they don't result in an external event that the person can't control. Would you say that was influenced by Jungianism and some of the things were going on in psychological astrology at the time, or where was that coming
sure.
from?
Yes, absolutely. And I actually still hold to that. It is my belief that the most pure and direct manifestation of a transit is when you experience it inwardly. And for lots of complicated reasons, people frequently don't. The most reliable manifestation people get from transits is the change of mood or feeling. Mm. External events are much more negotiable. But the internal – it's very hard, for example, not to feel somewhat somber during Saturn transiting opposition the moon, whatever may be happening in your world.
Sure.
I also have to say that the psychological interpretation was in part required by the fact that these were computer program databases. And external events require taking an awful lot of other things into consideration besides the transit itself. If you're just going to be talking about the transit, then you really are primarily stuck with the personality or psychologically oriented interpretation.
Sure. Due to it being more reliable in terms of feeling that transit when it comes up.
Exactly.
And you were actually going through like a Neptune transit or something at the time when you were writing the book, right?
Oh, yeah. Conjunct my sun, would you believe?
And you didn't know at the time what it was going to be about, but you happened to be writing the book at that time.
Yeah. Well, actually, it did have a more obvious manifestation, which is that was around the time of the 186 scientists condemning astrology.
Okay.
And I had a period there where I was really wondering if I was crazy believing in this stuff, even though I experienced it as being very powerful. And oddly enough, the result was that it got me onto the course of studying the philosophy of all of this that has led to the point now where if I'm confronted with a materialist, I can demonstrate to him that he's an idiot.
Sure. Well, that and in the 70s, that would have been a really...
I mean, on philosophical grounds.
So the 1970s was kind of an interesting time with respect to science because on the one hand, there was a lot of astrologers that were getting very interested in doing scientific testing, and you had organizations like the NCJR, ESAR, forming in the 70s and 80s with statements in their very names about doing astrological research, presumably from a scientific standpoint. But then on the other hand, you have scientists who, like the 187 scientists who signed that document essentially saying that there was nothing to astrology. So I can understand how that, for somebody like yourself, that would have been a kind of a difficult time in which you would have done some soul searching.
Yes. And of course, I was one of the people who, well, I would have been even more intimately involved in that movement if I had at the time the computer expertise to do something about it. I have it now, but now I've come to the conclusion that astrology as a testable subject suffers from exactly the same problem as the social sciences do, because it is in fact a form of social science. Quite frankly, rigorous scientific methods don't work too well in those either.
Sure.
But the other thing, of course, that eventually changed my point of view on the subject was the encounter with traditional astrology, where I realized that part of the problem might be due to the fact that we were testing an astrology that was too seriously flawed to be testable.
Right. You ran into that issue with the suicide study, right?
Yes, specifically, because when the suicide study began, I eagerly participated for a while. Then I realized I didn't have the foggiest idea what to look for suicide.
Sure, you're right.
And it wasn't until I studied traditional astrology that I began seeing what at least theory would suggest you should look for.
Right. You guys were trying to do a statistical test with the New York NCGR on charts that were indicative of suicide to see if there's a statistical correlation, but you ran into an issue where there wasn't even a clear developed methodology for what that would even look like in a birth chart necessarily in modern astrology.
Yeah, the statistics was fairly minor. The question was, can astrologers, given a pair of charts, one of whom is a suicide and the other is not, can the astrologer tell to a statistically significant degree which one is which? And the answer was pretty uniformly no. Mm-hmm. But there were actually some really gigantic methodological flaws in that, which would have nearly made it impossible. You know about control groups, I assume.
Sure. You could explain it quickly for our listeners.
Yeah. When you do a study of this kind, you have a population that has the condition, in this case suicides, and a population that has similar statistical characteristics that is not suicide. Mm. Okay. When I say similar statistical characteristics, that is, they shouldn't be radically different in period of time.
Right.
For example, if you do suicides from the 20th century and non-suicides from the 19th, you will find all the suicides in the 20th century have Neptune-Pluto sextiles.
Mm. Right.
Because everybody had them.
Sure.
So they have to be approximately the same socioeconomic category, approximately the same date distribution. But what actually happened was the controls – I may be wrong about this, but the information I finally got was the controls were picked because they looked like they might be suicides.
Okay.
That's not the way it's supposed to be done. Because but even so, the larger problem is there was in fact in traditional – or excuse me, in modern astrology, no theory as to what suicide should look like in a chart.
Right. I mean, partially because that's not something you would even – modern astrologers would want to say to a client, because they would A, not to make some sort of prediction like this person will be a suicide, but B, because their entire approach to astrology is more psychological in orientation and not directed towards making concrete predictions like that.
Well, what I do now when I see those indications that I have learned to identify with potential suicides, I say you have to be very careful about making lifestyle choices which are self-destructive.
Okay.
And that actually is what it means. It doesn't mean suicide. It means lifestyle choices that are self-destructive.
Right, yeah, because I remember some of the ancient delineations tend that way in terms of that's symbolically what it's indicating in terms of connections between the first house and the native and what they initiate in the eighth house and
exactly.
Whatever brings yeah. about their undoing.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, so that was one of your first real issues that sort of brought up that issue, but then it wasn't until a few years later in the 1990s that you had, I guess you already had the interest, but you got the opportunity to become involved in some of these translation projects in order to revive and restore some of the older traditions. And that became kind of like you became one of the leading proponents of actually doing that within the modern astrological community.
Yeah, and I think I can safely say I have done more education in this field than anybody else has since then. Because at that time I had 3 years of high school Latin and 1 year of college Latin, and my Latin was well, the interesting part is I never forgot any of it, but it wasn't what I'd call good. And now I've had, in addition to that, several years of graduate school Latin, medieval paleography, and I work with people who are professionals in the whole area of working with manuscripts and so forth. So I'm now actually a fully trained professional medieval translator.
Right, and you recently completed your PhD.
Right, and the PhD was, the title is, the use of military astrology in late medieval Italy, the textual evidence. And one of the longest appendix is 85 pages of Latin, which is not translated. What I do is I say, look at passage such and such, and I give the first and last words of the passage, and then I do translate the passages I refer to, but the appendix includes entire areas of books that I had to copy from early modern texts and manuscripts, edit and clean up, and most importantly, copy. I've gotten to the point now where I can read most of those medieval Latin texts if the print is reasonably clear at sight.
Sure. So that's a long way from doing, you know, cosmobiology in some of the modern astrology books in the 1980s to and having, I guess, your BA or your – did you have your MA at that point, or is it just your BA?
Just my BA. I had a BA in history. No, as a matter of fact, the reason why my graduate school career took so long is I had to start by getting an MA.
Okay.
I was doing the whole thing this last 10 and a half years.
Wow. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So out of all of the astrologers, we've probably seen the greatest transformation. But it's just interesting to me, and I guess that's part of what I wanted to explore, because many modern astrologers don't see what the draw is and don't understand why anyone would be interested in traditional astrology. And a lot of people look up to you and yet perhaps don't fully realize some of the changes that you've made in your approach to astrology in the past 20 years, not just in terms of, I guess, technically speaking, but to a certain extent philosophically, and also in terms of your more academic orientation now.
I've always had a tendency in that direction, but now I'm no longer an amateur in it. That's the basic difference.
Right. You have the actual credentials. So,
And the training.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, it's all right. Go ahead.
That brings us to our main point, or our main topic, which is something you've been talking about a lot recently, which is rebuilding the links between modern and traditional astrology. And I'm curious about this because you've advocated, and obviously you've been developing your own particular way. I mean, anybody who has attended one of your lectures in the past 10 years has seen that you blend some traditional and some modern concepts. And so I'm curious what your views are when it comes to this question of whether modern and traditional astrology can be reconciled. Do you think that they can be reconciled technically as well as philosophically? And what's your approach?
First of all, there are two aspects to doing astrology. I mean, two broad ones. There are many aspects, but two broad ones. Okay. One is the astrological tools and techniques that you use to analyze a chart. Mm-hmm. And the other one is what you're doing with the chart. Now, some of the reasons for the differences between ancient medieval on one hand and Hindu, I would also put in the same category, and modern Western astrology, is due to the fact that there is a humongous cultural difference between our present time and the times then.
Sure.
One of my favorite examples is if you see a young woman in her late teens having extremely romantic and sexually oriented configurations in her chart, if she were born in India, that would mean she was about to get married. If she was born here, it means she's having her first affair, and maybe not even late teens. But, you know, the culture dictates, the traditional Indian culture dictates that be marriage or basically you're doomed, and ours has a variety of approaches. It's not so much that we're free. The word I would prefer to use is indeterminate. That is, what we do, what we can do, and what we can do with what we've got is not as rigidly determined by historical and cultural circumstances as it was in Greece and Rome in the Middle Ages and traditional India. They may become that way again, but that automatically brings about a major difference. The other major difference is, of course, that the introspective quality of modern life is much greater in the mass population than it was in the ancient periods. I was just talking with somebody else earlier that one of the first really introspective biographies ever written was Augustine's Confessions. Mm. And at the time, even, that was a radical act. And that whole business of doing spiritual, shall we say, inventories became particularly powerful after the Franciscan movement began in the Middle Ages. So that, in turn, led to the kind of introspective issues that developed, that have manifested in modern time as psychological astrology. Here is the issue. What techniques one uses, ancient, medieval, Hindu, or modern, have nothing to do with what you use the techniques for.
Right.
And I think it's extremely inappropriate, not for philosophical reasons as merely, but for practical ones as well, to bring the kind of deterministic attitude that you find in the three traditional astrologies into modern astrology without serious revision. Because of this greater indeterminacy in modern life and this greatly increased introspective tendency. Is everybody in our culture introspective? No, but the people who get into this stuff tend to be, and they didn't in the traditional cultures.
Sure. Well, and that brings up a question that often – an argument actually that I see playing out, and it will probably be one of the main ones, which is your point on the one hand that culturally things are different and people have greater – latitude to operate socially in modern times, at least in some countries. But then on the other hand, this argument that some traditional astrologers push back against on modern astrologers, which is an argument that some people make against traditional astrology, that things are so radically different that traditional astrology no longer applies in the same way that it did 2,000 years ago or 1,000 years ago or even 500 years ago. And some traditional astrologers push back against that and say that the fundamentals of life are still very much the same in terms of what the major components of a person's life are, the major people that you interact with, and the major things that are important to human beings. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, this is one of those classic instances of a highly polarized argument where both sides have a case.
Right.
And the truth is somewhere in between. The cultural conditions are radical. I'll give you a concrete example. In some 19th century text, I've forgotten which one, I think it was Leo, but I'm not sure, a moon-Venus square was delineated in a woman's chart as being an indication of loose living, low morals, and so forth. Mm-hmm. In modern astrology, all we would say is this is somebody who really likes to be loved and to give love, and it may be a little turbulent. And the difference is not the astrology. The difference is the culture's attitude toward women and the feminine.
Sure.
So the idea that this is not the same culture as the three traditional cultures that gave rise to astrology. I'll toss in Arabic there too. That makes four. But at the same time, making the translation isn't particularly difficult.
Right.
And for some reason, having now studied intimately the nuts and bolts of medieval astrology in the original language, I can tell you that medieval times were much more like modern times than most of us realize. But still, the rigidity of a person's life determination caused by their social position was much greater than it is now. Bonatti, for example, nobody knows whether he actually got a degree at the University of Bologna, but he certainly was there. And during my dissertation defense, something interesting came up. One of my committee was a full professor of canon law, the only full professor of canon law in the entire United States, I might add, mm-hmm. as Catholic University has the only canon law department in the United States. And canon law, of course, is completely written in medieval Latin, and he was surprised to discover in the passages of Bonatti on lawsuits that his language was exactly like this. Well, I won't say exactly, but he clearly had studied canon law.
Okay.
Because his language was correct, the Latin.
Sure.
Now, so he was obviously a very well-educated man. Well, this meant that he wasn't likely to be plowing fields.
Right.
He was not a member of the nobility, so that took care of that. He certainly wasn't a member of the church. So all of these things excluded vast quantities of possibilities from his life, although he was probably left with more possibilities than most people because he was basically a middle-class person in the modern sense.
Sure.
And that indeterminacy of the middle class had already begun. This is a middle-class culture. That's why the indeterminacy level is so high. But at the same time, yes, there are basic issues that we all have to deal with. But I would like to make some suggested comparisons. If a person gets an illness now, depending on the illness, of course, the chances are they're going to have a bad time and they're going to recover. Getting that same illness in the Middle Ages was probably a death sentence.
Sure.
The whole issue of what constitutes marriage and relationship has radically changed. And oh, by the way, probably the single greatest deficiency in medieval astrology is relationship analysis, which is one of the biggest fields in modern astrology.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, basically, you married somebody who was local and practical, or your marriage was arranged for you. But in any case, you didn't have a whole lot of say in the matter. And the main thing you wanted to make sure of from a man's point of view, and it was all from a man's point of view, which is another big change, that the wife was clean, reliable, honest, and was not likely to disgrace him.
Right.
And, of course, bear children. And that was it. They could hate each other's guts as long as those other things were. But now we have this whole idea of romantic love, which is another, by the way, medieval creation.
Although
that had to occur outside of marriage, however. That was the interesting thing about it.
Right.
It could not occur in it.
Although, on the other hand, we do have things like even the conceptualization and the practice of synastry originating probably in the Hellenistic tradition. And so...
Yeah, it just isn't with anywhere near the degree of elaboration that it has now. But yes, the idea goes back to the ancients.
Sure. So that makes sense in terms of philosophically. Although even philosophically, if we take it back, one of the issues, for example, that Campion talks about, one of his arguments against Hellenistic astrology being invented suddenly, is that there's so many different philosophical approaches to astrology in the ancient world and in the Greco-Roman period that really argues against it just coming out of one place or one philosophical school. And that in some ways is almost helpful because you can't look at traditional astrology as one monolithic thing philosophically.
Right.
And there are pieces of traditional astrology where the philosophy certainly could be seen as complementary to modern Western astrology, I think, right?
Absolutely. You've raised a very good point. If you're going to talk about philosophical differences between traditional and modern astrology,
mm-hmm.
You really do have to say, well, which philosophy of ancient or medieval astrology are you talking about?
Right.
For example, the one that is most not only most compatible with modern astrology, but is actually the ancestor of the philosophical foundations of modern astrology is Neoplatonism.
Mm-hmm.
Madame Blavatsky simply repackaged Neoplatonism in a somewhat Baudelaireized form with lots of Sanskrit terminology. But her worldview is basically Neoplatonic. And most spiritual astrology is descended directly or indirectly from her. I personally prefer to go back to the source, and when you do, you find the statement I've commonly made that if you really carefully study Plotinus's attitude to astrology, you'll discover that it was virtually identical to Rudyard's.
Right, because he wasn't against astrology. He was just against an astrology of causes, like a Ptolemaic astrology.
Yeah, exactly. There were, in fact, three major philosophical strains in ancient astrology, the Platonic, the Hermetic, which is close to being Platonic, and the Stoic. Aristotelian, people often say that Ptolemy was an Aristotelian. I would say actually only insofar as everybody was an Aristotelian to some degree in the ancient world, because by his time the philosophies had all begun to mush together. And in fact, the philosophical foundations I am beginning to write about for modern astrology are quite blatantly Neoplatonic, with some stuff that has been provided to us by modern science. Have you ever studied Neoplatonism at all?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I've spent the past few years doing, is just studying ancient philosophy so I can understand Hellenistic astrology better.
So you know what the emanations are. You know what emanation is.
Yeah.
Okay. Even modern books, you will find no really good explanation for how it works. I mean, what is the relationship between the various hypostases of the various hypostases? They're not of God because they're all different aspects of it, and nobody really gives a good answer. And there are all sorts of theological problems that it gives rise to that are actually, if you look at the at what's going on in contemporary mathematics and physics, you can actually see a model there for how they could be related, minus the reductionist tendency of removing the living element. I don't go with. But the idea that, for example, we can be in God and God can be in us is a real strain to a Christian, but not to a Platonist.
Right.
Now, the medieval, of course, you have another set of issues, which is that both the Christian and Islamic astrology occurred in a monotheistic context, which had a great deal in common, as a result of which the Arabic adaptations of Aristotle were, with only a little bit of difficulty, turned into Christian adaptations of Aristotle. So medieval astrology is completely Aristotelian. And I don't have a problem with that. There are many aspects of Aristotle that are very useful to understanding how astrology might work. But the physics has to go,
right?
At least as physics. As something else, it may have value, but we can't use the science, natural philosophy of Aristotle particularly well, because it simply isn't correct unless you make really major modifications. I've actually seen some that could be made that would make it almost right, but almost usable. But I don't have – everything I want from Aristotle is in Neoplatonism anyway, because it actually is an Aristotle-Plato synthesis.
Even the I guess I haven't looked into this enough, but even the notion of – in Platonism you have like a final cause, because that's something you've talked about and you seem to draw a lot on from Aristotelianism, is the four causes.
Yes, the idea of codifying them into four and defining them so precisely is Aristotle.
Right.
But the idea of efficient – the ideas of them can be found in Plato. He just didn't systematize it the way Aristotle did.
Okay.
I tend to take the Platonic view that a form pre-exists its material manifestation. That is, it can't exist without the material manifestation, because we have since learned that matter isn't particularly material anyway.
Sure.
And it's just a set of mathematical functions, which is very, very Platonic.
And especially the final cause seems like something that you've been interested in integrating into a philosophy of astrology for a while now, right?
Yes. And of course, if you have to understand that a final cause may not be attained, but I believe the chart is actually a way of determining one's pathway toward achieving one's final cause, or at least going in the right direction. And this is completely Aristotelian, and yet it's the astrology of self-realization.
Right. So how would you describe that to somebody from a traditional standpoint of integrating the final cause and what that actually means in an astrological context?
Well, first of all, I go back to a doctrine of fate, which I found in a fragment of Hermeticism. The precise nature of it is peculiar to the fragment, but the idea is all over the place. And that is there is a fate that is the result of being physically incarnate. And you can't do anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
There is the fate that is due to limitations in awareness and consciousness, which appears to produce an inevitable outcome, but it's actually only your lack of awareness that makes that happen. And then finally, there is the fate that comes about as you unfold toward what it is you're supposed to become. And where traditional astrologers, I believe, have a problem, and this, by the way, is not supported by traditional philosophy at all, by the ancient philosophies at all, is they tend to see everything as a sort of flat earth. They don't realize that everything can operate at several different levels, and this is not merely Pollyanna modernism. I have a fairly substantial number of Tibetan Buddhist clients. They are not only Tibetan Buddhists, they are people who are fairly prominent in the Tibetan Buddhist community.
Mm-hmm.
quite a few of them will be easily found on Google. They have been getting all of the stuff going on in the tropical cardinal signs. They've been getting clobbered. How are they doing it? How are they doing it? They're not having any – well, they're having transformational issues, but they're not having problems. They're just changing, and they know it, and they're going with it. Their lives are not falling apart. In fact, they're becoming more fulfilled. Right. I have many clients who do this routinely, and there is no way in the chart you could tell that they would do this. Mm-hmm. It's just a potential if you evaluate the chart as being several different levels of possibility.
So you embrace the idea that modern – partially modern, but to some extent traditional notion that the level of consciousness of the individual in some way dictates how they'll navigate or whether they'll successfully or unsuccessfully navigate the transit.
Yeah, although level of consciousness is a somewhat mushy term.
Right.
The clarity of their self-understanding would probably be the better the clarity and fidelity of their self-understanding would probably be a better way of putting it, mm-hmm. is the variable.
I mean, one of the things that I often think about when it comes to that, or one of the objections I have to the modern view of that, is just sometimes it seems like there are some things, like you were talking about the being subject to certain things in terms of your fate physically, like sickness or illness, to mm-hmm. whatever extent that some illnesses can't be avoided or are not something that you necessarily brought on yourself. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's the first level of fate.
Okay.
You know, the physical universe, we're here. Well, like it or not, we're here. We may have some role in creating it, but not individually. It's a collective creation at the very least. At the very most, I should say, not the least. So the other aspect of fate is what other people do.
Right, right, which is...
For example... How many times have I looked at an afflicted Neptune in the fourth house and says, one of your parents, possibly your father, had an alcohol or drug problem? And almost invariably the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Now, they didn't make their father happen.
Right.
You may have some considerable control over your own life, but you have very little over other people's.
Right.
The only choice you have with other people is which ones to associate with. And in the case of parents, that's pretty bloody well fixed in fate. There are things that you can't rise above. But the most common thing is you can't rise above things that you don't understand the workings of. And so while the correct word is ignorance, it has a problem of its being pejorative. An ignorant person is usually considered to be an idiot or a fool. Well, unwitting would probably be a better word. It's not that we ignore, which is actively choose not to know, is that we don't know. Right. And what we don't know becomes fate.
Sure. Okay. I think that gives some insight into in terms of how traditional how you might reconcile some traditional philosophical schools, that there is actually a rich philosophical tradition and many parts of it could actually interface very nicely with some of the places that modern astrology has gone philosophically.
Actually, I'll give you the biggest one. It's characteristic of Hermetic, mm-hmm. Neoplatonic, and medieval astrology, all of them. It is their opinion that the fated manifestations of the planets are most likely the result of the changes they induce in the physical body. And to the extent that the rational intellect, as properly understood, can separate itself from the impulses of the body, they've become free from fate. That fate, at least.
Sure. Yeah, that's huge. That distinction between the mind and the body is huge in Hermeticism.
Yes. And it's also pointed out that the soul or mind, depending on what you want to call it, has two parts, the part that is most subject to the parts of the body and the part that is less subject to the parts of the body. And here you have the unconscious and the conscious mind. Hmm. That idea comes right out of ancient philosophy. It isn't so, the term unconscious mind is modern, more or less, but the idea isn't.
Sure. Yeah, that does provide a pretty good parallel or pretty important one in terms of the modern and ancient philosophical traditions. So then let's move on then. So technically then, how or in what ways can modern and traditional astrology be reconciled? Like, one of the big things I think that you discovered and became known for was you started making discoveries that astrology as it was practiced 2,000 years ago was very different than it is practiced today. For example, whole sign houses being one of those things that you guys didn't necessarily discover, but certainly confirmed and became, it actually gained widespread exposure after your work in the mid-90s.
Yeah. The technical aspects of traditional astrology are the ones that are most can be brought over most unchanged. Because what you do to manipulate the symbolism of the chart has, as I say, nothing to do with what you're doing it for. I'll give you a modern example. My former partner, Gary Kristen, is one of the leading practitioners of Uranian astrology, which by most people's standards is very much like medieval in being rigidly deterministic and very event-oriented. Mm-hmm. I overheard him giving a consultation to a client several years ago, and it was not like that at all. He was doing exactly the same sort of thing that I would do, only he was doing it with Uranian. Mm-hmm. So the purpose to which you harness the techniques is separate from the techniques. So what I think that modern astrologers have to drop is the idea that the technique somehow harness you to a fatalistic approach. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, I was recently looking at a book on what I would call modern psychologically oriented astrology, and what struck me was that everything was stated entirely in terms of personality. It's not psychological so much as it's characterological. Mm-hmm. It was just about personality. And it obviously was completely incapable of dealing with things coming in from outside that really do come in from outside. And this is where traditional astrology really is much more useful. It is far better for indicating what kinds of actual circumstances may surround a given set of transits than modern astrology is.
Sure. Talking about actual concrete circumstances in the environment or the life of the native.
Yeah. But here's an example of the difficulty. You have Neptune going over for the Sun in the 10th house. That would be Pisces nowadays. Here's the question. Does this mean your job is about to get screwy, or your father or mother are about to need to be taken care of very badly? Or are you going to have a major spiritual awareness experience that will change your life direction? And the answer is yes. It could be any of those.
Right.
And while the more you invoke the other methods of traditional astrology, you can narrow the more you can narrow this down somewhat, but you can never get it to one scenario.
Right.
Unless the person has made choices in the past to make only one scenario possible.
Yeah, that's a really important point, that traditional astrology allows you to narrow down the significations to a more likely or manageable number, but it doesn't eliminate all of the possibilities completely.
Exactly. And that's where the reconciliation actually occurs. Once you understand that even the most highly symbolically determined delineations have manifold forms, the more you realize that traditional astrology does allow for a multifaceted approach. It is not rigidly deterministic. Those people who believe that the only reason why astrological predictions are wrong is due to the deficiencies of the astrologer have a very hard case to prove, because I just don't see it happening. And I have my pulse on the finger of what goes on in astrology pretty well. I haven't seen anybody, Hindu, medieval, or whatever, who can actually tell you what an event is going to be in advance of the fact by purely astrological means.
Sure.
Yes. That last statement is important.
Zoller already had said something to me once about that. He said that I thought was insightful. He said that astrology allows you to know things that you shouldn't otherwise be able to know, but it doesn't provide omniscience.
No, it does not.
So,
no, it's basically the function of astrology and freedom is to dispel ignorance as much as possible.
Okay. So that makes sense. So technically, technically speaking, there's a lot of things about traditional astrology that could be adopted by modern astrologers without necessarily changing their philosophical approach to astrology. And in some ways, you're evidence of that. But let's talk about, because there are some significant technological, there's some resistance to adopting traditional astrology, largely, I wouldn't even say because of the philosophy, although that's obviously a problem, but whatever the perception of the philosophy is, but there's resistance to sometimes very drastic changes in the techniques, whole sign houses being one of them. And that, I think that you have been become the major proponent for. So what would you say to somebody who has not heard about whole sign houses before, or who perhaps has heard about it but's resistant to the concept?
Well, you know the old cliche, you can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Right.
That's part of the problem. In this respect, I think I'm different from a lot of people, although not entirely. I'm 71 years old, and yes, I'm fixed in my ways in a number of areas. When it comes to astrology, not terribly. As soon as I see something coming from a source that I think is worthy of being paid attention to, I pay attention to it. And what do I mean by worthy of being paid attention to? It's intelligent, well thought out, well reasoned, and I can see if it works or not. Mm-hmm. There will always be a certain number of people who can't make these changes because it is a psychological reality that the older one gets, the more difficult it is to learn something completely new. I doubt very much that I could have learned Latin from scratch in my 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Having learned Latin in high school, I was just simply building on a structure that already existed, and now my Latin's pretty good. I wouldn't care to sit down and write a Ciceronian essay, but I can certainly read a Ciceronian essay, even if it makes me want to do something horrible. But having made that breakthrough with Latin, I am now slowly acquiring Greek.
Nice.
Because they think alike.
Right.
Not identical, but they think very – the only language I know of that you can almost perfectly translate into from Greek philosophy is medieval Latin. Medieval, not classical. The medievals had to confront the issue, and they did it almost perfectly. They came up with a complete Latin vocabulary for all of the terms of ancient philosophy, and the words are precisely equivalent.
Right, and that actually led to an issue in the astrology, which is that we call houses now instead of places, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's a major problem, all right. Because and for that matter, the word in Latin locus, which means place, is used ambiguously. I've been recently going over the old work we did on Montulmo with an idea. What I'm doing, however, is I'm not retranslating it. What I'm doing is I'm editing the Latin because I have the manuscript on which the printed book was based, and now I can see where misinterpretations may have occurred. But at any rate, Montulmo frequently uses locus, like examine the place of the sun, locum solis. And you don't know if he means house or the degree position.
Right.
If he were being strictly rigorous, he would mean the house.
Right. Yeah.
And usually when he means degree, he says gradus, which means degree. So what we did before was we translated as place and left it alone and made a comment, this may very well mean house. Now I'm convinced it means house. Because the Middle Ages, the use of locus for a house was still around. As we can see in German, where to this day, the 12 houses can be referred to either as Häuser or Örter. I believe Örter is the proper plural. The latter means places.
Okay. So this is – it almost shows a continuation of the language, certainly. But, I mean, whole sign houses were still being practiced 1,000 years after the introduction of Hellenistic astrology.
Oh, sure. They were – most of the early writers in Arabic used them.
Right. And that actually becomes – because you're one of the only people that's commented on this question of, you know, if whole sign houses was the dominant form of house division for the first 1,000 years of Western astrology, and it seems to have been after the concept of houses were introduced somewhere around the 1st or 2nd century BC. But then in the medieval tradition, sometime around the 9th century or maybe a little later, we see this sudden shift towards using quadrant houses very quickly and almost the complete forgetting or neglecting of whole sign houses after that point. Why did that shift happen?
Never underestimate the capacity of the right individual in the right place at the right time. More recently, we have the case of Placidus, whose methods were adopted by and large without attribution by John Partridge in England. And Partridge was the last of the significant early modern astrologers in England. And so everybody followed him.
Right.
Consequently, the dominant house system in England and America up until relatively recently was the Placidus house system, not because it worked better, but because somebody taught it. Well, the single most towering figure, practically speaking, in medieval astrology was Abu Mashar, who set about doing a reorganization of astrological ideas on largely a priori principles. Now, I don't know if he's the one who switched the emphasis from whole signs to alcapitious, but he's in exactly the right place. And I think he did. His most notable contribution was the idea that the triplicities correlate with the Aristotelian elements, which I think was a mistake.
Right.
Because it doesn't make sense. And there was also, of course, a certain amount of lore prior to him that suggested that houses might be done differently. We have the two famous instances in Hellenistic, which are Vettius Valens, who describes quite clearly a Porphyry house system. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we have Porphyry saying the same thing a little later on. And then we have Rhetorius's use of a form of alcapitious houses in surviving charts. In none of those instances do we have indications that they were using them for signification.
Right.
They appear to have been using them for angular succedent cadent or intensity. So something happened around the time you identified, about the time of Abu Mashar, that caused that shift to occur. And it was clearly done with the idea that they were making astrology more scientific. And this happened a lot in the early modern period, too. People would make changes in astrology to make it more scientific. And the outstanding example of this actually is Placidus.
Right. And one of the – I think you said also that it started happening with Abu Mashar around the time of the commentaries on Ptolemy. And I really like that idea because we actually are still having the same debate that they may have had in the 9th century today, mm-hmm. where some astrologers will say – you know, because Ptolemy doesn't mention the houses very frequently, and the first time he actually clearly outlines a house system explicitly, it's a quadrant house system within the context of the length of life technique. And some people argue that that means that that was Ptolemy's preferred house system. But I've shown elsewhere that he was clearly using whole sign houses everywhere else outside of that one chapter.
Yeah, and there is the issue I mentioned in whole sign houses of one particular text. Do we read it is the degrees that are in dextire sextile to these? The Greek can be translated as also known as the house of the good spirit or good demon, which would make it the 11th house, mm-hmm. and which are also in the house of the good spirit. There are manuscripts that do it both ways.
Okay.
The usual reading is the former one, but the latter one would say that it has to be an overlap between those degrees that are in dextra sextile to the rising degrees and in the house of the good spirit, which would be different.
Right. So one of the issues is that people may have basically read those passages of Ptolemy and taken that as the house system that he was using, and therefore, and to some extent at least, the complete ignoring of whole sign houses and this sudden shift towards quadrant houses may have been, or at least one argument or one theory is that it may have been the result of a misunderstanding about how houses were being used early in the tradition.
Yeah, I think the commentaries on Ptolemy probably do have something to do with it because that could easily lead in that direction.
Sure. And so that's one area where we're going to have to do some work in terms of a lot of people are switching to whole sign houses. It's actually really striking even in the past 5 or 6 years, I've been amazed at, I've seen some polls recently on two different forums about which form of house division do you use. And whole sign houses in the past few years has suddenly jumped up there as the second most used, or in at least one traditional poll, in the most used house system. Because lots of people, even modern astrologers who don't use traditional astrology, are suddenly adopting it for a variety of reasons.
Oh, not the least of which is that sun sign astrology has always done it that way.
Right. Sun sign astrology always derives whole sign houses from the sign of the sun.
Yeah, exactly. Michael Luton had actually been using whole sign houses in regular work as long as because of his experience with it in sun sign astrology. He has an interesting combination. He uses both Placidus and whole sign houses. And what he's done is he's created the same dilemma you find in Indian astrology, where they use the Shripati system, which is which is related to the Porphyry and the whole sign houses. And I've never been able to get a straight answer out of anybody as to when you use which and for what reason.
Sure. Yeah, and that might be what happens. I mean, there's some talk about attempting to synthesize these two systems of a quadrant system and a whole sign system to see if that works. Although most of the people that I know who start playing with whole sign houses eventually just convert to it and end up using that 100% of the time.
Yeah, there is the one irritating problem in whole sign houses, which I think I know the answer, but I can't prove it on the basis of texts, is do the degrees in each house that correspond to the ascendant, which would be the equal house cusps, basically, are they cusps in the original sense of the word in the whole sign house system? For example, there is a lot of death which requires the cusp of the eighth house, and that goes back to Greek sources.
All right.
But there are no calculations of the lot of death anywhere. So we don't know whether they were using 0 degrees of the eighth house or the degree in the eighth house that was the same as the degree of the ascendant.
Right.
And that would be very interesting, because it means you could derive the fundamental ruler of a house from the degree of the ascendant in that house. Just sure. the way people do a quadrant house. I don't know. I mean, it's I basically try not to make anything I say dependent on that issue.
Sure.
So because I don't know.
There's still things that we're working out. And then there's other techniques, technically, in terms of what traditional astrology might have or what you've been using. One of the other issues, I think, are arguments is the traditional rulerships, and then secondarily the issue of using the classical aspects versus incorporating minor aspects. Where do you stand on those?
Okay, I definitely am with the old rulers.
Okay.
I use the medieval variant more than the Hellenistic variant, but because I do think the scoring system, while it's not precise, does give you some sense of the relative power of the various dignities and rulerships. Montolmo, by the way, used the Ptolemaic system. He was the only Latin astrologer I found who did. He considered all dignities to have a score of 1, and he did not use decans. He used aspect as the fifth rulership.
Okay, so Ptolemy did as well, I think.
Yeah, it's completely from Ptolemy. He's the most Ptolemaic medieval astrologer I've found. He's late 1300s.
Okay.
Yes.
Rulership.
That system is too intricate and too effective to tinker with. The only area where tinkering clearly needs to be done is the issue of the bounds or terms, because we've got one system, the Egyptian, where everybody agrees and where they are, and the other major system, the Ptolemy, is a family of systems because there are quite a few variants. I don't know if you ever read Deborah Holding's paper on the subject, but the general conclusion of her paper was that we do not, in fact, know what Ptolemy's terms were.
Right. Yeah, and she
with any degree of certainty
presented that at the Blast as well, and at the last Blast in 2008, and it was a very interesting paper.
Yeah, that was actually a somewhat better rendition than the one she did because she thought about it a bit more. But the paper she published
Culture and Cosmos.
Culture, so that was rather where the Culture and Cosmos is gives an adequate description of the problem.
Sure. So, yeah. But in terms of domicile rulers, you would prefer, or you do prefer, the traditional system over the modern system of assigning, for example, Neptune to Pisces, Uranus to Aquarius, and Pluto to Scorpio.
As far as I'm concerned, the modern system doesn't exist. It's bullshit. You may edit that out if you like, but I let me tell you why I believe that.
Sure.
It isn't because it's modern. I don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
For when I first started studying astrology, I was, of course, mostly influenced by Ebertine and people like him, and I didn't use houses at all. Mm-hmm. And I didn't use rulerships at all.
Okay.
Then when I moved to New York and spent a winter there working with Henry Weingarten and Barbara Sommerfeld, they more or less reinforced my position because they were pretty strict cosmobiologists. Then I moved to Boston, and there everybody was doing conventional, mainstream, modern Placidian astrology. Mm-hmm. And they kept saying, well, you really ought to use – by this time I'd already started using houses, at least for occupancy. I started using Placidus because what else was there? And then I converted to Koch because Edith Vongerman came and gave workshops in New York and Boston where she described the system, and I was very impressed with what she did with it, so I converted to Koch. But then they said, you got to use rulers. And I started using rulers, and here's what happened. I found they were the single greatest source of error in my analyses.
Okay.
What you were supposed to be able to do with rulers, I too frequently could not do. Mm-hmm. And that led me to the conclusion that rulerships didn't work. Well, then in the 90s, when I learned the medieval system and learned about Almutans and things of that sort, I said, hey, this actually works. It makes sense. And the last key in that was, of course, changing to whole sign houses. So it isn't so much that I was converted from the modern system to the medieval system. Is the medieval system was the first one I found worked at all reliably. And when I find modern astrologers using house rulerships with the modern planets, I find what they do with house rulerships is extremely mushy. For example, most people don't know that there is actually a functional difference between a planet in a house and a planet ruling a house. They're not the same, mm-hmm. but they're used interchangeably in modern astrology.
And what is the distinction?
No, they don't make it. They don't make any distinction.
What is the distinction from your standpoint?
Well, putting it in practical terms, the major distinction is that in any matter, the early stages of the process are indicated by the occupants of the house and the outcome by the ruler.
Right, right.
Because the ruler is a formal and final cause.
Okay.
Now, does this always give you a clear difference between them? Not always, but it does more often than not. And it is this fact, actually, that is why horary astrologers, or interrogational, as I prefer to use the term now, you make the rulers more important than the occupants because they want to know the outcome. And the occupants don't give you as good an idea what the outcome will be. See, the occupants of a house are the material cause. Well, obviously, an inappropriate material cause is going to screw up the result of a house. Mm-hmm. So you see, you can get something of the outcome. But another doctrine that this explains is, why is it so bad when a planet does not make an aspect of a house that it rules? And the answer is because then it can't contribute to the outcome.
Okay.
Which brings us back to the aspect issue. So this might be a good time to segue to that. But there is in fact a pre-modern use of minor aspects.
Pre-substantial. Which is from who?
All over the place, India particularly. It's just that nobody recognized it.
Sure.
The divisional charts are, in fact, a way of finding minor aspects, or at least the ones that are truly harmonic charts are. Mm. What I've come to the conclusion is the major aspects are to be used primarily in the first harmonic. That is, that's what you read when you read the chart in a regular way. Mm-hmm. Now, even in traditional astrology, there are some exceptions. For example, a sextile or a quincunx between signs that have the same ruler are considered to be valid.
Right.
And they're okay. And, of course, you also have the antithia and contra-antithia, which are not aspects. But I have, as a result of my early experience in astrology, never quite gotten the idea of giving up semi-squares and sesquiquadrates.
Okay.
They're not as powerful, but they seem to work. They basically are like, you know, slightly less intense squares. They are conjunctions in the eighth harmonic. So the minor aspects, I think, probably do work if they're really close. And here is the technique I actually believe one should use as a guide. I don't want to be too rigorous about this, but the major aspects should have the orbs that traditional astrology assigns them, more or less. Mm-hmm. The minor aspects should have the same orb divided by the harmonic.
Okay.
So if you if a conjunction between two bodies is say 10 degrees, then the semi-square would get 2.5 degrees.
Right.
And because it's actually an aspect in a divisional chart. So I do not wax eloquent over quincunxes that are 3 degrees out, regardless of the sign. The other exception is, it is evident from things that Masha Allah states in various places that any planets that occupy the same degrees of their sign interact regardless of the aspect between the sign.
Right.
That gives you partile quincunxes and semisextiles. Partile meaning they are in the same degree. They have no orb, in other words.
Okay.
So that's another resolution. So those are the guidelines I work with, but I very seldom will base anything major upon a minor aspect.
Sure.
So I think the major ones are truly major.
So then the reconciliation there between modern and traditional astrology is to perhaps integrate the minor aspects in some way, but to treat them sort of categorically or at least somewhat differently in terms of the amount of importance that's given to them.
Yes, I agree. That's exactly it. And now that we have whole sign houses, probably the best way to do this is to actually create the harmonic charts.
Right.
But that requires that we have a clear understanding of what the number of the harmonic means.
Yeah.
The first harmonic is perfectly straightforward. That's everything.
Right.
Second harmonic, we typically don't bother to use independent. The major aspects in any harmonic chart would be valid, first, second, third, fourth, whatever. Mm-hmm. If you go to a second harmonic chart, which I wouldn't bother doing, then the semi-squares and sesquiquadrates become squares.
Okay, right.
But this is a suggestion. I don't do it. It's a suggestion. So I've got to leave work for somebody else to do after all, and believe me, I will.
Yeah, there's a little bit too much. I think we're clearly very early on in this revival of traditional astrology, and we're already starting to see some evidence of the synthesis, but there's so much work left to be done that obviously it's going to take a while before the outcome of that is really clear.
I have to share with you an observation. The last AA conference I attended, which was a couple of years ago in Britain, I was officially told and saw very clearly that the split between the moderns and the traditionalists had ended.
Okay.
The two groups had decided they were both worth listening to.
Sure.
And I assume that'll happen here too. But you see, the British astrological community is a much smaller one and much more tightly integrated. Ours is kind of diffuse and, of course, spread out over a monster of a country, size-wise, I mean.
Well, and they also got a bit of a head start on the Americans by about 10 years because the Lilly revival occurred in the UK originated there. And then it wasn't until 10 years later that you have Arhat and Project Hindsight.
Zoller was actually the first practitioner of traditional astrology.
Right.
But he didn't have too many followers.
Well,
we actually gave him a platform.
Right.
Which he's used very well.
Yeah. And he really sort of – his popularity definitely took off after that point, after the mid-90s. And then it's interesting because also even there were guys like Holden who was publishing papers with the AFA like on whole sign houses in 1981 or 1984.
Yep. Holden was the other one, yes.
Right. And he was even publishing translations privately or circulating translations of many of these texts like Retorius and Paulus and a few other astrologers privately for many years. And it's only recently that they were published.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he was another man ahead of his time.
Yeah, definitely. So that gives us some ideas, at least philosophically and to a certain extent technically, how traditional astrology might be reconciled or how we can begin building some of the links. Do you have any advice for people, like if somebody's a modern astrologer that doesn't have any background in traditional astrology, what their starting point might be or how they could start looking into traditional astrology, but just in terms of like how you might make the transition technically, like if you use Placidus normally and you use the modern rulers.
I have a very simple answer. I do exactly what I did.
Sure.
I used a European-style chart form in which the planets were placed in their proper degrees, and I drew lines for the house cusps, and I had the signs of the zodiac and a ring of their own around the outside, so I could either read the houses or the signs.
Okay.
That's a very simple way of doing it. And that way you can – nobody for any purpose whatsoever should be using what I call the 12 pieces of pie chart, where all the houses are drawn as 30 degrees regardless of their actual size and the planets are just written in. You really do need, I believe, to see the geometrical structure of the chart. And this is one of the cases where it is extremely useful because you can see the house and the sign if they're separate, and you can conclude which one gives the better information. And I've had – of course, you know, I'm getting a – I have a selective audience here, but I'm getting an awful lot of people who've been telling me that nothing in their chart made sense until they changed the whole sign house system. But I'm sure there are also a lot of people out there saying I've done you know, thousands of charts with both, and I find whole sign houses are a lot of crap. I just don't hear from them.
Right. Yeah, a lot of people seem to – the main hesitancy seems to be that some people are so used to looking at their own charts in Placidus or whatever for so many years that they come to identify with those placements, and so the biggest hurdle for them becomes re-understanding or reinterpreting their own chart and how that makes sort of a shift in how they understand their own life.
Yeah, the really big one is the really big thing we discovered was that thing in book 5 of Valence's anthology, mm-hmm. where he starts talking about what happens when the midheaven falls in the 9th house or the 11th house.
Right.
And the interesting thing is about a few weeks before that, I was talking to Robert Schmidt, and I said, you know, I wonder if the ancients would have used the midheaven somewhat the way they apparently used the parts as alternative ascendants.
Right.
So the midheaven could float, and whatever house it landed into would have to do with career issues. And then came this passage, and that it was, I would say, 80% of the way to what Valence was describing. Not 100%, but about 80%. And so once you have that understanding of what the midheaven and the IC do, it becomes a little easier to work with. I would have a great deal of difficulty throwing out my Pisces midheaven.
Sure, right.
But it's in the 9th house. And in fact, my initial problem with either modern or traditional rulers is that my 12th house is occupied by Saturn and Uranus, depending on which modern house system you use. Mm-hmm. And Saturn and Uranus both rule, depending on which rulers you use, the 8th house, or the 9th house, rather, which was Aquarius in all the quadrant house systems.
Right.
And I couldn't see where that would contribute to my interest in philosophy, ideas, so on and so forth. Well, in whole sign houses, I have a 9th house midheaven.
Right.
It has two rulers, Mars and Jupiter. Mars trines out on one side and Jupiter on the other, and they're both highly dignified.
Okay.
So there all of a sudden you can see why I would have a strong 9th house interest, and there would be a decidedly spiritual or mystical direction, although I don't do the jargon that most spiritual astrologers do. I prefer the older language. It's cleaner and more precise. Like, for example, I'll give you my favorite word for this, soul. Mm-hmm. Ask an astrologer what part of the chart shows the soul. Well, if the astrologer is really thinking, they should return that question with a question. Says, what do you mean by soul? And they typically don't, because everybody thinks they know what it means.
Right.
And every time I use the word, I say I use this word for two specific things. One is it is the faculty which makes a living thing alive. The presence of soul makes a living thing alive. And two is in sentient beings, the soul in particular is what makes it that particular sentient being and not somebody else.
Sure.
So the answer to the question, what part of the chart shows the soul, the answer is the whole thing.
Right.
But we have these problems with definitions that are really a mess. So that's an example of how I changed the dialogue somewhat in spiritual conversations.
Sure, as well as an example of your general ninth house interests and how,
yes.
I assume something that you're going to talk about in the workshop, which is that in reality you do take into account the degree of the midheaven and the degree of the IC. They just import their significations into whatever whole sign house they fall in.
Yeah, it means my career has to do with ninth house issues.
Right. Yeah, I always use your chart as the best example of that, of somebody who is – whose MC has fallen in the ninth house and has clearly made their career out and is very well known for ninth house topics, primarily astrology as well as other things.
People with late Gemini and people who have the Gemini Aquarius combination, which was the one Valence was talking about, are particularly fascinating because you find, I would say, a disproportionate number of these people I found interested in ceremonial magic.
Okay.
Is that they want to take a very cerebral, well-organized approach to these issues.
Sure.
I don't mean ceremonial magic to cast spells. I mean the genuine white magic.
Sure. Okay. So those would really be, I guess, the three main issues in terms of stumbling blocks that some people have is the rulership issue, the aspect doctrine issue, and then the house issue.
Yeah.
And that, I think, gives some people some good ideas about where they might want to go and some things that they might want to try experimenting with in terms of that. So where do you see astrology going? Like, where do you see astrology in 10 or 20 or 30 years?
Well, I think what we've been talking about is going to continue. I am not sure that, in fact, we're going to see astrology accepted as a mainstream subject, such as the sciences and social sciences are considered. Mm-hmm. That's going to require much more massive change in the consciousness of our culture. The reason is very simple. You might find this interesting. Go on to our website and you will find that under Our Hot Journal there is now a blog. And I've posted 12 principles. Not that I intend to stop at 12. It just happened to be where I stopped. Of what a metaphysical foundation of astrology should include. Yeah. And the single biggest stumbling block to astrology is that astrology is a strong indication that there is something alive in the universe aside from us animals. Mm-hmm. There is something living in the universe because astrology is a language. Mm-hmm. It's several, actually. There are several dialects of astrology. And a language presupposes a transmitter and a receiver. Well, we're clearly not transmitting.
Right.
And something is. So, you can't have logos without mind. And so a worldview which preaches that mind, soul, life, and so forth are epiphenomenal, mm-hmm. and that everything is the result of blind chance working with a certain number of mechanical laws or statistical laws in the more recent varieties is absolutely irrevocably incompatible with astrology. The scientists are right. If we're right, they're wrong.
So in that sense, then, is astrology not amenable to science?
It's not amenable to what we call science, no. And that's the whole point of what I've started to do on the blog, is that I'm trying to outline the philosophical foundations of a science that could include astrology. Because remember, what does the word science mean? It means knowing.
Right.
Knowledge. The original word, which I think really needs to be resurrected because it's much more honest, is natural philosophy or philosophy of nature. Mm-hmm. And that also makes it what is really clear that science is not opposed to philosophy. Science is a philosophy.
Right.
People say there's no philosophy in science. Well, as the expression goes, the fish will be the last to discover water.
Sure. I guess one of the things that people often bring up when they ask, is astrology a science, or when scientists ask that, is what they mean in some sense is also, is astrology amenable to the scientific method? Can astrology be proven or demonstrated within the context or the constraints of the scientific method? Do you think that's possible, or is that there's something?
Well, we know it's possible because it's already happened.
With Gokulin?
Yes, the Gokulin data. And interestingly enough, by the way, I don't know if you ever had this discussion with anybody, but the whole sign house system with a couple of corollary ideas is the only house system that can actually explain the Gokulin data.
Right, because the Mars sectors occur just before the ascendant. And
and way up above it.
Right.
And that So, in other words, if you postulate that a strong planet rising has to either be near the horizon or above it, and in the rising sign, which is the first house, mm-hmm. Well, you get exactly the Gokuland distribution.
Sure.
And if you do the same thing with the Midheaven, you will get it again. You get the Midheaven and ascendant, the ascendant and Midheaven peaks being in the cadent side of the angle.
Right. So in every other house system besides whole sign houses, that would not fit the contemporary astrological wisdom that holds that angular planets are more prominent or are stronger in some way.
Yeah.
Whole sign is the only one in which it actually makes sense of that data.
Though I would still define the angular 10th as being the angle of the midheaven as being the sign that contains the midheaven rather than the 10th sign. The meaning I would give to the 10th sign to some extent, but the power I would give to the sign that contains the midheaven.
Okay, in making that distinction between the dynamic houses versus the topical houses.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The Gokuland issue proves the dynamic issue, and to some extent the topical.
Well, then, to whatever extent that's true and that works out, then that would show another area where some things that have happened and have developed in modern astrology could be amenable to and could complement some things in traditional astrology.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I look forward to seeing what else you post on that blog and your website. Again, it's rhotmedia.com, correct?
Right.
Okay.
And the blog is accessed by going to the button marked it's a rectangle marked Arhat Journal.
Okay. And you'll be posting there more frequently from now on?
Well, I just made my first post this week. I will also continue posting on my Facebook page, of course.
Okay. Excellent.
The Facebook page is going to be more slightly more meat and potatoes, and the blog is going to be my far out weird stuff.
Sure. And now that you just finished your PhD, what's your plan? I mean, you're obviously doing a lot of webinars recently. Are you going to get back? Are you going to be publishing anything soon, or are you going to be writing books?
I am writing books. Yes, I have several that are in various stages. One of them is going to be the book that I started writing at the beginning of this whole process, which was the book on essential dignities. And I'm glad I didn't try to publish it earlier because I would want to revise it completely, and that's what I'm doing now. I'm revising the book. I wrote a full-length book, but I never was quite happy with it. So now I'm going through and cleaning it up and bringing it up to date in my terms of my understanding. And one of them is I've given a philosophical foundation to why a planet – well, here's the famous instance. If you believe in the 12-letter alphabet approach to astrology, mm-hmm. Where Aries is one in the first house and Mars,
right?
Then why is Mars exalted in a sign of Saturn, but Saturn is debilitated in the sign of Mars?
Right.
And if in fact the planets and the signs are just two variations of the same basic principle, that can't be true. Therefore, Zipporah Dobbins, for example, rejected exaltations on that basis.
Okay.
What I do is I show exactly what the difference is and why that's the case.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, that's going to be a really great book then, because that will probably present the case that a lot of modern people would need to see have made in order to make that transition perhaps to traditional rulerships or to using exaltations or bounds or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
All right. Excellent. Well, I guess that's it then. Your workshop is this weekend. It's on what are the dates again? It's December 14th and 15th?
It's coming Saturday and Sunday, and they start at 10 a.m. Pacific time, which gets everybody in at a reasonable hour except the Aussies. At some point, I'm going to have to do a collection of webinars for Australia.
Right. Okay, excellent. Well, everyone should check out your website, which is rhotmedia.com. And thanks for coming on the show.
Okay, it was my pleasure.
All right. Okay, well, that's it for the Astrology Podcast. So thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, then please rate it on iTunes, and we'll see you next time.